This is the Workflow Show. I'm Nick Gold. I'm accompanied by my cohort, Merrill Davis. We're of Chesapeake Systems, episode 107.
Howdy.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Hey, usually I say howdy.
Oh. Well, you know.
Oh, my God. We really are merging.
Seven whole episodes, man.
Yay, seven.
Seven.
Lucky seven.
So what are we talking about today?
Today's episode. And it's funny because, you know, Merrill and I were like, what should we do next week? And
we actually said it in that voice. That's our thinking voice.
And it's
what
funny.
We were
going through all these things that we've talked about with asset management and the workstation and the editing platforms and archive and backup. And it's funny because, you know, I've been at Chesapeake for 8.5 years now. Can you believe that?
That's almost a decade.
And
sorry,
the vast majority of what we've done over those years, I mean, a huge percentage of it involves work group storage systems for media work groups. That could be video editors predominantly, and it's storage area networks, also some file servers, but it's this work group storage that multiple people can be using at the same time. And we haven't even done an episode about storage yet.
I think a lot of it was, you know, intellectually, this was something that we sort of assumed was an accepted part of the environment.
Yeah, and then we get our typical 8 phone calls the last week where people are like, I'm sick of stacks of FireWire drives. And it's like, oh, gosh, we can't ignore this because it's still an issue.
It really is fundamental to everything that we've talked about up to this point.
Storage. It's not sexy. It's a freaking hard drive icon on your desktop at
the end
of the day.
It's true. And, you know, I think the thing that's probably the biggest hurdle with regard to this is that this is that part that requires you to interact with your IT department. And your IT department...
if you have an IT department.
Right. Or the, you know, your neighbor's kid. But the IT department is typically centered around network infrastructure as it relates to the overall organization.
Yeah, you know, like sending email and getting on the web and pushing software updates.
General connectivity, that sort of thing.
They're not thinking about, like, I need to pull 4 streams of video simultaneously that are each several hundred megabits of bandwidth. They're like, huh? Video takes that much space?
Or you know, in many cases, I know we've come up against, certainly with a certain set of clients, that the idea of a network addressable piece of storage that has a Mac integration at some level is totally, you know, out of the realm of their comfortability.
Comfortability is
a fun
so
word to say.
Not a word.
Comfortability? It's totally
like,
a word.
It's not even close
outside
to being
of the
a real
realm
word.
Of comfortability.
Comfort.
Tability.
The tability is completely superfluous. The word is comfort.
Tability. All right.
Okay.
So anyway,
so
but it's
tability,
about comfort.
Tability.
It's about, so you may be working in a video environment, but you may not have somebody necessarily who has their video visors on when it comes to addressing how to get storage on a network.
Yeah. And you might, I mean, and we'll get into this in more depth in a few minutes, but you almost never want your video storage network to be the same network as your general network. It's gonna get ugly real fast. So let's break down kind of what we want to talk about today. Let's start with kind of the challenge, although we will be getting more into this next week with episode 108, growing pains, as we're gonna describe it, because next week we're gonna really kind of take a lot of the things we've been talking about over the first couple of months here and relate them to like a hypothetical environment where growth of your organization and your data storage needs and the number of editors and the complexity of projects is kind of what you're facing. And we're going to walk through how to phase out the kind of expansion of your facility. But right now, we are going to talk about some of the immediate challenges that might lead you to looking to put in a consolidated networked workgroup storage system. And then,
otherwise known as a SAN, possibly, or it may be something else. But
it could be a NAS.
Could be a NAS.
Those are the same three letters, but in a different order.
They all sound like rappers.
Yo, I'm MC Sam.
Well, actually, I believe there is a rapper named Nas.
But I think it's a Nas.
Oh, well, excuse me.
But I think it's spelled like Nas.
Yes.
We're going to talk about kind of why one technology might be more appropriate, the different cost points, the performance that you may need for your editing tasks, and which of the technologies might be compatible with that. So we're going to guide you all through this wonderful topsy-turvy world of video workgroup networked storage systems today on the Workflow Show.
On the Workflow Show. The Workflow Show.
Workflow Show.
Workflow Show. So let's start somewhere fairly simple. All right. I've worked in the field for 10 years. I spin off a company, and finally I've got my own edit suite. I've got my own slew of clients. Typically, up to this point, it's been me, the editor slash videographer slash, you know,
producer.
Whatever. Yeah. Or as the term that I actually dislike intensely these days is predator.
Predator?
To catch it. Yeah. Producer, editor. It's a prevailing term used a lot. You know, they're looking for predators. Go on Mandy.com. Go on, like, New York City.
I'm picturing Craigslist. Like the aliens from the Schwarzenegger movie with the weird faces with, like, Predator, you know,
yeah,
where they
no.
like pulling people's skulls off and then using them as trophies. I mean,
well, so, you know, but I that's
which is cool, but I don't really want to be like hanging out with them editing.
Well, you know, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that in that environment, you have a self-sufficient individual who is dealing with a significant workload.
Yeah.
At some point.
Jack of all trades.
Yeah. Well, you know. And at some point, that's going to grow. So, you know, we have more jobs than you have time or edit machines.
Yeah, more projects. You've started outgrowing drives. You got a few people working on different machines.
So you add the other machine. You add another seat to your editor.
And what does this inevitably become, Merrill? What does your storage situation typically look like if you are like almost everybody else on the entire planet?
A stack of freaking hard drives.
You know it. You hate it. You. But gosh, why do they multiply like rabbits? I mean, so let's look at the challenges, right? One challenge: ever-growing storage needs. You just have more and more. No one wants to throw everything away, and these days everything is tapeless, and so you're not really like pumping back out to video cassettes. You just keep everything on hard drives now. And USB or FireWire, which is typically what we run into in the editing world. Those drives, they're cheap. They're tempting.
They're designed to be cheap, and they're designed for short-term use.
We've run into situations as a reseller where it's like cheaper for us to buy a 2 terabyte FireWire drive online than it is to buy a raw, just blank SATA hard drive. For some reason, sometimes, you know, those manufacturers, LaCie, G Technology, those guys, they just get they sell so many of these things. Their volume, you know, purchasing, you know, weight that they carry is so great that they can sell them for barely more than the cost of the actual hard drive mechanisms inside of those things.
But, you know, it's not a good way to go long term.
Yeah, here's two big problems, right? Your data starts to get split over bunches of these and organization becomes a challenge.
That's
number
correct.
One. Number two, they fail.
They do, and they fail. Let's just ask the question. Have you ever had a hard drive fail? If any of you told me no, I'd say you were lying, because everyone has had a hard drive fail. I've had them fail.
Yeah. They're not
in any matter
great.
Of devices.
You know, in computers, you know, two things fail, I think, just in my experience over the many, many years I've been using computers since, like, being a wee little lad. Two things fail more than anything else. Number one, hard drives. Number two, power supplies. Those are like, it just seems like 9 out of 10 problems, an actual physical hardware problem a person has with a computer is their hard drive dying or their power supply pooping out. So, you know, some users who get into this pattern of developing stacks of FireWire drives, they may manually make copies between them. They may use ones that have hardware RAID mirroring capabilities.
But still, it becomes so unwieldy.
It's unwieldy. It's
especially,
ugly.
Especially because you can manage it. And I've seen guys do this. They think, I can do this. I I have a good sense of how to organize my files. I've always kept these things in order. I did it in the past, and there's no reason why I can't do it now.
As the season 8 mid-season finale of Breaking Bad that I was watching last night makes really clear, momentum and just the having done something in a certain way for an amount of time... I think they use the word inertia in the episode. They're talking.
What are you talking about?
They're
like,
talking about
way
why.
To just be, way to tell like the whole world. By the way, I'm watching Breaking Bad.
It's so good. I'm overwhelmed with how good of television program it is. But they talk about inertia, right? And the inertia of using these little FireWire drives, which we've been using for like 15 years now to edit video off of, and it just kind of works. And maybe you have had a failure or two, but they're cheap and you can kind of get away with it. And as you're, so you take on a new client, you just buy another drive. The inertia of using that system kind of just keeps you going down that road until it just becomes unbearable. And here's the things that I've run into that typically drive someone into starting to think about a SAN. And again, we'll get more into this a little more in depth next week, but it's typically like, drives are dying, and they're like, oh my God, using these little flimsy FireWire or USB drives or whatever, SATA drives.
I mean, do you have any drives?
Isn't working.
Do you have any drives from projects that you did 10 years ago?
People do. Lots of them.
Yeah. They don't fire up.
Yeah. You're just sitting on it, and we talked about this in the archive episode or the archive and backup episode. Hard drives sitting on a shelf not getting used, catastrophe waiting to happen, because when you go to plug it back in and fire it up, everything that used to be a lubricant making that thing work has kind of congealed over the years and frozen the hard drive, and
speaking
it locks up.
Speaking of congealed over the years, I was watching NewsHour with Jim Lehrer the other day, and,
That's so funny, because I was just thinking about Jim Lehrer randomly, last night.
I just figured I wanted to share my viewing habits as well, I mean, if we're going to do this.
What, are you supposed to be all, like, current and up-to-date, because you watched the...
He retired!
Who did?
Jim Lehrer.
No, he didn't. It was McNeil, I thought, who... McNeil died, didn't he?
No.
You know.
He left last year. I'm going to Google this right
okay,
now.
Okay, listen, I watch Breaking Bad. I'm not going to feel bad about it. Just
I watch PBS.
You watch PBS.
I'm not
going to
feel
news,
bad
okay?
about it either.
So
PBS
anyway...
PBS is great.
The inertia breaks down when you start to experience drive losses. You plug these things in. Or another common thing that gets people starting to think about work group storage versus these stacks of FireWire drives is when you do have multiple users, multiple workstations, and you need to kind of like have multiple people with access to the same group of footage at the same time, because now you have to buy an extra drive, make copies of the data. Takes a lot of time because this video stuff is big. You're waiting to copy stuff between the drives. People are working off of different versions of the files. You're not using your storage space efficiently because you are duplicating it amongst drives. Once someone's working off their island of storage, as I like to call it, the other person is working off of their island of storage. Pretty soon you've got an archipelago of storage.
Isn't island of storage that Kenny Rogers and a Dolly Parton song?
I don't think so.
Oh, wait. You know what? That's Islands in the Storm, isn't it?
We could do a play on that, though. Yeah. A storm, storage. Anyway, so everyone working off of their own island is going to create additional bottlenecks and, management issues. And so people are like, wouldn't it be great if we could just all be editing off of the same big drive in the sky?
And you know what? I would just something to add to this. I've encountered, as an editor myself, I used to have this mindset. When an editor has spent most of his time in a closed environment, the idea of not having immediate local access to the files that you're working on is not necessarily the most palatable thing to an editor that has spent his entire time working locally off of a hard drive. I mean, it does require...
You're saying the idea that this storage device that's centralized is sitting in a rack somewhere and can't just get thrown into your backpack is a little queasy-inducing.
Yeah, I think especially if there's a sense that I always will have access to it, and I can do with it what I need to do when I need to do it.
And now it's going to be this.
Now it sits somewhere.
It's in a rack. It sounds awfully enterprise oriented.
And what
am
I supposed to do? I got to move things from location to location. I was at a client the other day that they are not insubstantial in their size, and they do very large business with in the commercial world and television. And there are stacks of FireWire throughout 8 suites.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me.
Yeah. They frankly probably outgrew that methodology 6-7 years ago. However, it happens because of inertia. And so there are things to weigh. There's certainly costs. But what does moving to a workgroup storage system net you immediately? First of all, the vast majority of them are based on RAID storage. So it's redundant sets of hard drives all added together into a massive volume that, because the data is redundantly getting splayed, as I like to say, across a bank of drives and individual hard drives failing does not jeopardize immediately your actual data integrity. That's something, just RAID redundancy of your storage that a workgroup storage system essentially is inherently going to offer, because basically they're all made up of RAIDs. You get that immediately, and it's an immediate net benefit. You know, data loss is less likely. As we like to say, a RAID is not a backup, but having a RAID as the basis of your storage makes it a more robust storage system than what many people have in these desktop drives, which is usually either an individual hard drive, and if it goes belly up, it goes away and you've lost your data, or often 2 hard drives, like a G-RAID, right? Everyone's run into G-RAIDs. The reason they're a little bit larger is because they have 2 hard drive mechanisms inside and they get striped together. So the size and a little bit of the performance gets added together. The problem with a 2 drive RAID 0 striped G-RAID like it.
I know this.
What is it?
If one hard drive fails, you're fakakta.
So, and let's get into statistics mode. Statistically, if you've got a 2 drive RAID 0 desktop FireWire drive, and either one of the 2 constituent hard drives dying means you've lost all of the data, you are how much more likely to experience data loss?
About as likely as you are to experience a bunch of rage in the middle of the street.
The correct answer is a doubling. You are twice as statistically likely for that volume to die because either of the 2 drives that make up that volume.
My answer is also
accurate. Yours is a little more poetic, I'd say. So RAID is something that a workgroup storage system is probably just going to net you right away. It's more robust storage than your average desktop drive. It's also probably a lot bigger than your average little 2 drive or 1 drive desktop drive. So it's just a more unified container for your data, right? That's just, it's going to be 6 or 8 or 16 or 32 or several dozen hard drives all added together into this volume that people are connecting to.
Sure.
So,
it
leads to the stuff just not being scattered around amongst multiple drives.
That's true. I mean, and there are half steps in this sort of journey to centralized workgroup storage. And that is what a lot of times we see happen is my individual FireWire drive ain't cutting it. So let me get like a CalDigit 4-bay RAID, which is certainly better than a single hard drive.
But it's not necessarily solving this fundamental problem of multiple people accessing the same volume.
That's right.
Or significant. You're just going to end up with more of those things over time, you know?
But wait, I've got a nice new iMac. And
I love it when you go into like, third-party mode, like the imaginary person.
Yeah, well, I've got a lot of imaginary people in my head, so this is what allows me to interact.
Can you make this one just happen to be a clown?
Okay, but wait.
Honk, honk.
I'm a part-time clown, and I make clown videos for both weddings, bar mitzvahs, and my YouTube channel. And I have an iMac, and I've got some Thunderbolt, and I've got a Pegasus Thunderbolt RAID, and you know what? I'm smart enough to know because I have an IT clown uncle. He went to clown college with me.
Honk, honk.
Yes. But so my IT clown uncle, he says, well, you know, you can just share all those hard drives over your network and just make sure it's connected to your local machine. And then I, as the lowly bar mitzvah clown, I decide, well, hey, that's good enough for me.
Stan, the lowly bar mitzvah clown.
Stan, the lowly bar mitzvah clown. Yes.
So I think he was actually at my bar mitzvah.
I stan the lowly bar mitzvah clown, right? I think that's a viable solution.
Why can't you just reshare these FireWire drives over Ethernet?
I've been sharing drives all the time. I mean, like, I got movies on my hard drive. I want to watch them. Why can't I just do that?
Yeah, go into file sharing and just share it out and, you know, maybe make it so someone needs to enter a name and password. They mount it on their desktop. Here's why, Merrill.
This is not for Merrill. This is for Stan.
Stan, listen, Stan, lowly bar mitzvah clown. Here's why you don't want to do that. Number one. You're not getting around the issue of having to push and pull data between drives and duplicate it and copying it. And if you are under the idea that you may be able to work directly off of someone else's shared drive directly across your Ethernet network, you actually can tax the CPU of the system that's hosting that shared drive because it's now acting as a file server in addition to being a machine that someone's probably trying to edit off of. And why would you want to tax them and burden them in such a way, Stan, lowly bar mitzvah clown?
Well, because I double booked bar mitzvahs this Saturday.
You had to hire kind of like Ms. Clown as the assistant editor. Yeah.
I had to hire an even more lowly clown than myself.
That's just sad.
Which was just a guy who put a little soot on his face and you know.
It's like the sad hobo clown.
Yes.
So there are performance ramifications to just hosting out your FireWire drives over Ethernet and having people work off of them. Or maybe they're pushing and pulling data, but then it's waiting to
copy.
But
I'm using Thunderbolt.
Yeah, Thunderbolt isn't really the bottleneck there. The bottleneck is your Ethernet network or your wireless network if you're silly enough to try that, Stan.
Well, the bottleneck in my life is the bottom of the bottle. Because I'm Stan, the lowly bar mitzvah clown.
No offense to any of our listeners who like
who might
side
who might
gig
be
as
bar
clowns,
clowns
and have like and alcohol have alcohol, issues.
You know, like for all you alcoholic bar mitzvah clowns, we're very sorry.
So, there's issues to that. So, and again, individual hard drives dying is still going to result in data loss. So you start to say, what if we put together a dedicated, centralized work group storage system? What is this going to look like? What are my options? What is the next phase beyond the StaxO FireWire drives or other desktop RAIDs?
Okay, so I think this would be a good time to basically, in case anyone has any illusions otherwise, what we are talking about here is still working off of hard drives. It's just how they're housed and where they're placed and how you interact with them. We're still dealing with spinning disk here. I think that's an important thing to note.
Yeah, it's not a different fundamental technology. It's the way of using that core storage technology and implementing it, the particular vendors who tend to deal with this space, the fact that, again, it's a networked device and not something that we call DAS or DAS, direct attached storage. So a FireWire drive or a little desktop RAID array is DAS, direct attached storage, because it's directly attached to your workstation.
That's actually my stage name, too. I'm okay. Daz the Clown.
Okay,
I mean,
Daz.
You make a checkout to Stan, but Daz is my stage name.
So now you're moving to the direction of a SAN or a storage area network or a different type of networked storage technology called a NAS or network attached storage. A NAS is just a fancy way of saying a file server. And we all probably have a concept of what a file server is. It's a drive you connect to as a client across a network. You mount it on your desktop. Multiple people can be hitting it at the same time and potentially working directly off of it. Some people are pushing data to, pulling data from, but it's just basically a file server. So the first thing to evaluate in a workgroup storage system is what route are we going to take? What even is the difference between a SAN and a NAS? What are the performance differences? What are the differences in cost? And what does one get me that the other doesn't? Well, that's question number uno.
So to address that question, first, I think we need to figure out how we want to handle our data specifically.
Gently.
Yes, with a sweet caress. But how we access the data is the fundamental difference between a NAS and a SAN.
Let's start at the basics, right?
Okay.
When you connect to a file server, if you've ever plugged your computer into a network and connected to a file server before, maybe it's in your office and it's where you have your Word documents or whatever it is, right? A file server, first of all, is using typically an Ethernet network. That means you're using Ethernet cabling with Ethernet switches. And the server, which is hard drives that are being hosted by a dedicated computer that shares those drives out, that storage, it might turn them into a RAID array. That RAID gets turned into a volume or drive or multiple drives that you connect to and mount. It has a server built in. It's running some kind of an embedded or fully dedicated operating system. It has its file services turned on. You've created user accounts with names and logins and passwords and set permissions systems on it. You plug it into your Ethernet switch. People, your client systems, your workstations, your laptops, your desktops are on that Ethernet switch as well. And then you have to connect to the file server using a file sharing protocol.
Dum-dum-dum. Yeah. You know, like when somebody says, well, you know, just /// the name of the server /folder.
Yeah. So there's always like SMB or AFP or FTP could also maybe kind of be seen as an example of this in a sense. But what we're really talking about is certain applications, they're often built into your operating system, that speak to a file server. And what they're really doing is that they're taking the drive that's built into the file server and kind of creating this intermediary layer that multiple people using their client systems are communicating through in order for multiple people to be writing out to that same central volume or reading data off of that centralized volume at the same time without actually writing over each other's data. So like,
wait, doesn't that make overhead?
It's really hard to respond to that, you know, even slightly seriously.
But the overhead. Okay, the overhead, right?
Well, there is overhead. So that's the thing about file sharing protocols, Stan. I'm just going to call you Stan for like the
you
rest
should.
Of my life.
My life is miserable.
Can you make a Hong Kong sound?
Hong Kong, help me.
Your horn is broken, Stan. Yes.
My horn's been broken since my wife left me.
Can you guys tell that we're recording this on a Friday late afternoon, by the way? I'm just throwing that out there. So there is overhead. These file sharing protocols, the common one for the Mac operating system is AFP or the Apple File Protocol. In the world of Windows, SMB or
Super Mario
Samba,
Brothers,
as it's sometimes referred to, is a very standard one. You have NFS and also Windows-oriented SIFS, which is tends to be kind of Unix-y, Linux-y as a file sharing protocol. When a person's writing to a hard drive, there's a little database that lives on that volume, that drive that you connect to, that rules where the data is actually getting stored on that physical device. The file system, again, is a little database that lives on the volume that determines where the files live, what their permissions are, lots of little things about the volume. When multiple people write to a volume at the same time, unless there is this intelligence behind it, unless there's that kind of mediated file sharing protocol and set of services involved, people would just stamp all over each other's data. And the file
system... Like my ex-wife.
Oh my God. Okay, we're stopping this damn thing. You're just back
That's
to Meryl.
That's what she said! And she took little kids. My little kids. Any little kids.
Our clownettes.
My children.
You
She took all seven of them. She put it in her car. We drive a Miata.
So the clowns drive Miatas.
Well, they're small enough to fit seven children.
Oh, I get it.
See, that was the joke there.
Ding.
Because it's a clown car.
Ding, ding, ding.
Because anybody who drives a Miata is a
clown.
It's a clown. Sorry for all the Miata drivers out there, along with the bar mitzvah clowns. But
These file sharing protocols are establishing guidelines and rules in real time that are determining who's writing to which section of these centralized file server blocks of storage so they're not corrupting each other's data. And yet there's an overhead involved to allowing that communication over an Ethernet network between you on your edit workstation and that central file server to happen. And this is why file servers, they weren't ever really originally designed for real-time video editing tasks of high bitrate video.
Well, you're never going to get the kind of performance that you want off of it, even if...
Well, you might. You might.
Well, you know, I guess it depends on file size and number of layers and a whole lot of other factors, but...
Well, here's the thing, right? So think about the internet and TCP/IP. TCP/IP being kind of some of the core protocols of internet working devices and how they communicate. And, you know, TCP/IP as kind of the underlying architecture of networks was developed for the purpose of being able to dynamically route packetized internet traffic around network outages. So, and, you know, there's debate as to whether this was really the core reason it was developed this way, but certainly an interesting application of this as far as the military was concerned, who were obviously large contributors to the early formulation of the internet, although not the sole contributors. But they were like, ooh, that would be great if one of our cities got nuked and we had networks between our cities or our military facilities. And now this traffic... this networking traffic is going to know basically how to route around a major outage and can still get to the recipient. And so if you kind of relate that to an Ethernet network, in an Ethernet world, if you are sending traffic to a file server, aka copying a file to it or capturing a stream of video off of a video feed, and you've got an ingest file server that has been tweaked to be good for real-time video playback and capture purposes. And there's a lot of subtlety to the way these things get built that make a file server a good video file server and a not-so-good real-time video server.
But I just buy something out of the box?
Not so much, because there's a lot of configuration issues. You are typically talking about file servers that have a more of a price premium associated with them than maybe some just off-the-shelf little... you know, LaCie network drive kind of thing. Those are cheap, but that's not what we're talking about here. So here's the other thing. A gigabit Ethernet connection, when you use one of these file sharing systems as your real-time workgroup video storage system, and you're connecting to it via a gigabit switch, and every client system has gigabit on it, well, in real-world terms, especially when you account for the overhead of the file-sharing protocols you use to connect to these file servers, even on a closed gigabit network, on a per-user basis, that gigabit Ethernet connection is netting you a connection speed that's about equal to a typical FireWire 800 connection. So if you have been in an environment where you're using like G-RAID drives or LaCie's little two drive drives that are in one box that have a FireWire 800 connector, moving to a gigabit Ethernet-based storage system, if the back end of the system is designed properly, I'll get more into that in a second, but if the back end is designed right, your individual editors will be able to pull about as much stuff in real time as they would off of a FireWire 800 drive directly connected to their laptop. So if that's how you've been working, you can probably get away with one of these gigabit Ethernet file server systems, perhaps. It's certainly not going to net you any more performance than you're used to. If you've been using direct attached eSATA drives, which perform a little better than that often, or these little desktop RAIDs, you may be moving backwards by moving to a gigabit Ethernet file server NAS as your workgroup storage system. Because, again, you're going to be limited to about FireWire 800 speeds on this type of a thing. Now, but think about this. So we have a file server with its own drives, and those drives may have very high speeds associated with it, but that thing needs to connect to the Ethernet switch too. If it connects to the Ethernet switch, assume again a dedicated gigabit Ethernet switch with a gigabit Ethernet connection of its own, and you have five editors on that switch, each with their own gigabit Ethernet connection, the singular gigabit Ethernet connection that the file server itself has and connects it to the switch now becomes the bottleneck, because despite the fact that individual editors maybe have a gigabit connection to the switch, if they're all feeding into the single gigabit pipe, if you will, or tube, because as we know, networks actually really are made up of tubes, that the file server is behind, that's now taking the gigabit Ethernet connection and splitting it, say, five ways. And so now your users, if they're working at the same time, are way lower performance than a FireWire 800 connection. The way we solve this is that if you want to have a file server be the central server in a real-time video editing environment with multiple users working at the same time, and you need them each to be able to have roughly FireWire 800 speeds using that gigabit connection,
then what do we do?
10 gig E.
All right. So
Ethernet is 1,000 megabits. You don't need special connector types. You don't need optical transceivers, which we'll get to in a moment when we talk about fiber. A lot of people are looking at Ethernet now as a very attractive physical layer for these video storage networks. So
I think it would be worthwhile to mention here, because we've been talking sort of an abstract level, that we're still talking about
file servers,
and we're still talking about
NAS
RAIDs
that are
sitting in chassis that are in many cases rack mounted.
Yeah, these things don't necessarily look like a little tabletop 4 or 5 or 8 drive RAID array. This might be this kind of
16 bays.
Yeah, these are like these big honking pieces of equipment that typically get racked in like an IT server rack. They put out a lot of noise, and they have a lot of power requirements,
and
they generate a lot of heat. Yeah. So these are serious pieces of gear. You are stepping it up a notch typically, although there are some that are a little cheaper and less unwieldy to install. But we are moving to a class of IT equipment that, again, you might call enterprise oriented. It's the stuff that lives in the rack, not the little drive that sits on your desktop. But, you know, Ethernet, as we've been talking about, and using the typical file sharing protocols and using a well-designed, optimized gigabit Ethernet network with maybe a 10 gig path to a file server that itself has 10 gig on it is a very viable option. But, you know, again, we related it to FireWire 800. So you can probably pull 3 streams of ProRes high def off of it. You can, in real time, you know, as layers without having to render, you can probably pull 2 streams of ProRes HQ, maybe 3 if you're really lucky. You know, if you use a more highly compressed format, like 35 or even 50 megabit XDCAM HD, you know, off of an S-by-S card or, you know, XDCAM EX, maybe you'll pull like 5 to 6 streams of that stuff, maybe up to 7. DVC Pro HD tends to be about 7 streams. So you have to relate though that stream count of the complexity of the projects you're working on and how many simultaneous video layers an editor might have to pull. You know, if a cross-dissolve is 2 layers for that portion where it's the 2 layers of video dissolving across one another, before you render it for that brief portion, it needs to be able to give you 2 streams of performance. If you're doing the Brady Bunch thing and you got, you know, 9 little videos up at the same time, and before you render it out and flatten it, that's 9 streams of video.
The Brady Bunch thing. If you're doing an 8x8, or rather a 3, my math is terrible.
I think the Brady Bunch was 3x3.
Yeah, it was 3x3.
I don't think there was anyone in the middle or something.
I think that was the logo. It said the Brady Bunch and it came out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's what we're talking when you're making a tic-tac-toe screen of videos.
Yeah, we're not talking about modern, you know,
we're not talking
marriage
about
arrangements,
throwing
or
footballs at our little sisters and messing up their noses for the dance.
Bobby, you know, that's the Ethernet file server reality. Now, here's the thing about Ethernet. We've been talking about NASs and file servers and typical file sharing protocols that you would use to connect to these things like AFP, SMB, SIFS, or NFS, right? There's a little wrinkle, and it steps it up a notch, which is using a thing called iSCSI. And that's not a made-up phrase.
No, it's not, and it has nothing to do with Apple, as a matter of fact.
The eye is not like
no,
iPhone.
No, it's not eye. But you know, when
although you know what, they may have been a little influenced.
I don't know. They're certainly litigious in that manner.
So iSCSI, and SCSI is SCSI, or if memory serves, it's the Small Computer Systems Interface. Well, anyway, you probably, if you've been in this industry a while, remember SCSI drives.
How did you conjure that?
What's that? The Small Computer Systems Interface?
Yes. Because
I'm like the superhuman of Uber intelligence, Merrill. I tell you this every day. No, SCSI, the Small Systems Computer Interface.
We're not talking about these big old honking SCSI connectors from your...
No. I mean, because SCSI, as you might remember, used to use these big connectors. You'd have to terminate them and set SCSI IDs on every device that was part of your SCSI chain. But really what SCSI was at its core was two things. It was both those physical connector types, but it was also the way that the data got written to those drives using these things called SCSI drive commands. Different, and if you imagine it, more direct and to the point than packetized data over a TCP/IP Ethernet network or internet network. SCSI is kind of one of the ways that a system will write data to a drive that it's directly connected to. Well, we don't use SCSI drives anymore, but the SCSI drive commands are these what we call a block level protocol that writes data more granularly and more directly with certain levels of latency being guaranteed, where the data is always getting written out in the correct order, unlike packetized network traffic. SCSI is still a useful protocol and command set for writing data to drives, and they figured out a way to kind of marry gigabit Ethernet and SCSI data. And what they do is they use normal, yet it has to be compatible with it, but they used close to normal or their higher quality gigabit Ethernet switches that are optimized for iSCSI traffic, which is really SCSI drive commands being conveyed by TCP/IP protocol. And so it's kind of like a marriage of both worlds. It's a way of kind of passing SCSI data over an Ethernet network. And you kind of get a little bit more performance out of that gigabit Ethernet connection. Or it can be 10 gigabit Ethernet as well. But so we were saying how there's like overhead to the file sharing protocols.
This is like bringing your best friend to the party and not the entourage.
I like to think about it like cholesterol in your arteries. And iSCSI allows you to kind of scrape it away and get more out of that gigabit Ethernet pipe by using a type of data traffic that is more optimized for higher real-time performance without that overhead.
Recommended by 9 out of 10 doctors.
So the thing about iSCSI is that not every file server allows users to connect to it as an iSCSI device. Not every file server supports iSCSI as a way that people connect to it. And I talked earlier, Merrill, about how the nice thing about file servers and file sharing protocols is that they allow multiple users to write to the same volume at the same time. The thing about iSCSI is because it's the way that you talk to a local drive, you can't have multiple users using the iSCSI protocol on a gigabit Ethernet writing to the same volume at the same time, unless.
Unless what? Unless you have like a traffic director?
Well, now we're going to start talking about SANs.
Now, SANs.
SANs, SANs. And now let's talk about the difference between a SAN and a NAS. So with a NAS or network detached storage or a file server, it's the file server and its software that's mediating the multiple people writing to this volume or volumes at the same time without corrupting each other's data or writing over each other's data. And it's using these file sharing protocols that, you know, have evolved over the years. A SAN is a little different in that SANs, and this is the crux of the change of the definition, are oriented around multiple users writing to one or more volumes at the same time using these block-level SCSI command data sets, so it's more like talking to a local storage device than it is talking to a file server. But there needs to be some level of intelligent management involved to make sure that people aren't writing over each other's data because you don't have those file sharing protocols at play managing that. And what the SAN means is that it's multiple users writing to a volume at the same time or multiple volumes, and there is something orchestrating this system. SAN software and systems. This is a system that we're talking about here.
So we're talking about a specific software component that, I think I used a phrase before as a traffic director, but somebody who says stop, somebody who says go. If we have multiple people hitting the same volume and they need to achieve different goals, maybe somebody just needs to access some content to do,
and someone needs to be someone's edit. An ingest workstation, so yeah. They're always capturing to it.
Sure,
you
so
need
there's all this stuff.
SAN software, as you said, to manage this, to make sure that multiple people are using these block level protocols like iSCSI, and this is where Fibre Channel comes in. Fibre Channel is another SAN connectivity system that connects individual clients. And it's using fiber optic cable, F-I-B-E-R, fiber optic, but fiber channel, F-I-B-R-E, is actually not talking about fiber optics, even though it usually uses fiber optics. It's talking about what's called a fiber channel switch, which is kind of like, it's imagine it like an Ethernet switch, but specifically to route block-level data amongst multiple users and storage targets, as they're called. So you have kind of initiators and you have targets, and a fiber channel switch is a different beast and a more expensive beast, and yet a significantly higher performance beast, because these days, almost every port on a fiber channel switch is going to probably be about 8 gigabits. And the higher speed links on a fiber channel switch are going to be greater than 8 gigs. And most fiber channel storage devices are going to allow you to connect it to a switch with more than one 8 gig connection at the same time. We're talking about levels of performance that leave gigabit Ethernet in the dust. And so fiber channel has just all these other requirements. Usually you're using fiber optic cable. You don't have a fiber channel port built into your computer, so you need a fiber channel, what's called an HBA or a host bus adapter. And then you need the management software and likely management servers on top of the actual storage devices themselves to orchestrate this whole thing so you can present all of these spinning disks as a singular or several volumes and make sure that people aren't writing over each other at the same time and corrupting each other's data. So there's two main types of SAN, a file locking SAN, which is much like a file server in that it can be set up as one big drive, if you will, that people connect to. They're running SAN software on their end. They connect to this drive. And multiple people can be writing out data to the drive at the same time. We can all be doing captures. We can all be doing renders. We can all be tweaking project files that are on there and resaving it. Those are destructive kinds of operations that require write-level access to a volume. Well,
W-R-I-T-E.
Yeah, right. Write-level. Like, I'm writing data to it, right? And thank you for clarifying that. I'm not talking, like, in moral terms, like it's correct. No, we're writing data out to this drive.
Stan knows about those moral terms after his wife left him.
But to Stan, the decrepit, immoral
at this point,
clown.
Stan's actually aged at least 50 years. Now he's an old, sad clown, you know, washed up. This is because he didn't get the
You realize problem. We've lost any potential business that we ever had with, like, Clown Society of America's video editing department, right?
The Klein Society of America's video editing department, East Coast Division.
The clowns, we're going to get so many letters from the
yeah,
clowns.
Yeah, send in the clowns.
So in order to get to the point where you're writing this SCSI data over, let's say, a fiber channel or iSCSI network to a true centralized SAN system using these high bandwidth fiber channel connections or a 10 gig or a gigabit iSCSI links to get more performance out of Ethernet, you need servers running the SAN software as well. These are often called metadata controllers. They add cost, they add complexity, they add engineering to the whole system. That moment-to-moment are managing who's writing data to which section of the centralized storage at the same time. In addition to those servers, you typically need a whole separate Ethernet network just for the moment-to-moment traffic information to flow across. So Now we need to set up a fiber channel switch to actually have this media data flow across between the editors and the centralized storage system, the SAN, and then a whole separate Ethernet network usually, not the same one as your general network, because this still needs to be isolated, even though it's not the media itself flowing over it, because it needs to be a very high-performance, low-latency network for just like the traffic data about who's writing to which section of the SAN at this at a moment, so they don't interfere with one another. That's adding a whole second network to the SAN. More cost, more complexity. And yet, they're getting cheaper and cheaper. They're very easy for us to implement. I don't want to over frighten anyone about like how overwhelming it is.
They're not. I mean, cost really isn't the factor here. I think
There certainly is a factor.
Well, I guess the point that I'm making here is that while, you know, it is not insubstantial how much you must pay for a setup like this, ultimately, the type of workflow that you have and the size of your environment, the number of editors, the kind of, you know, the flavor of video codec that you're operating in.
Yeah.
All those things are ultimately the deciders, the decider.
Just adding all whole those syllables to words today.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, like, didn't GW, he once said he was the decider. So these are all the deciders. For why, oh why, we would go one way versus another. But yes, it's a costly investment, but it's the kind of thing that you can maintain over multiple years. This is,
they're easy to scale. We can fold storage almost invisibly into a true SAN or storage area network technology very easily and quickly in a way where an editor one day comes in and their SAN volume is a certain size, and the next day they come in and we've folded more storage into it behind the scenes, and it's just larger, but it's the same name, the same directory structure. We didn't have to back anything up or delete it. We can kind of expand it on the fly.
Grow as you go.
Yeah, it's a great, great technology. XSAN is one implementation of this. Mm-hmm. StoreNext, which is kind of the same fundamental software as XSAN, is the same. And that's what ActiveSAN has now.
Is that the Windows and Linux implementation?
Yeah, StoreNext is the XSAN file system. Apple licensed XSAN from, at the time, a company called ADIC that got bought by Quantum. And their original software was called StoreNext. Basically, the Apple version of StoreNext is called XSAN. A lot of people that we're setting these types of SANs up for now are putting in a StoreNext metadata controller.
But is that a Linux-based metadata controller?
Yeah, you're usually running a Linux server to manage this SAN system, but you're still using the XSAN software that's now built into OS X as the software to connect to it. And then we're usually using a number of different manufacturers, a fiber channel storage that goes on the fiber channel switch. You have these servers that are running the metadata controller software, the StoreNext software. They're on the switch. They're all also on the secondary Ethernet network for the SAN traffic data. And it's quite a production, but they are exceedingly high performance and wicked on every single level if it's appropriate for your environment and you can afford it.
Speaking of quite a production, so this is probably the most ideal and most we use reality television production as pretty much a go-to for all these scenarios, because I think it is the most video heavy, certainly in as far as the ratio of hours shot versus hours produced.
Yeah.
But there is just, if there was ever a time when you were just with multiple rolling cameras from multiple locations coming in, and they need to be ingested and then assigned to you know, assistant editors to do string outs.
One
and
of these SANs is ideal.
Yes. This
is going to be giant, high performance, hold lots and lots of video, because, again, the scalability is a very nice aspect of it. And everyone can be freely reading and writing data to and from that volume.
You got the transcriptionist just non-destructively pulling off video to
you got loggers, you've got ingest workstations, you got editors, you got producers. It's a very flexible system. Now, there is a different type of SAN system. It can be using gigabit Ethernet and iSCSI. It can be using 10 gigabit Ethernet even to connect the clients and the storage using the iSCSI protocol, or it can be fiber channel, and it's called a volume locking SAN. So whereas the file locking SAN, like XSAN and StoreNext, is often presented as one big volume, everyone is reading and writing to at the same time if they have the permissions. With a volume locking SAN, you strip away the machines that are acting as the management servers. They no longer need to exist. Each individual editor or client workstation is simply running a piece of SAN software that you use to connect, usually to more than one SAN volume that you've carved out of your RAID array. And your RAID, even though it's like, you know, maybe call it 16 hard drives, and we create a couple of RAID sets out of it, we have very flexible ways about how we can actually carve those into the volumes or drives users mount. In a volume locking SAN, we would probably actually present it as a number of drives, because the rule of it is you have to use this volume locking SAN software to connect to the SAN volumes, and only one user can have read and write access over a volume at once. However, multiple users can have read-only access off of a volume at once, even while someone may be writing to that same volume. So think of having this little app, gives you a list of volumes, and you have users, and they can choose a volume and mount it either read-only or read-write. First one who could mount it read-write, because of the way the permission system that you've defined works, who mounts it read-write, kind of locks to the volume. And now only can people mount it read-only until that original person relinquishes the read-write access.
But I think it's an important distinction to make here that simply because you do not have write access does not mean that you can't engage in work, because we're dealing in a purely digital world here where editing, when it comes to making edits on your timeline, is non-destructive.
Well, so let's talk about what things in the workflow of typical video requires read-write and what requires only read-level access.
Ingest is read-write.
Yeah, because you're creating files on a drive. So if you are copying things off of a P2 card to a drive, or ingesting video from a videotape, if you remember what those are, or a video feed or a camera directly, that's requiring read-write because you are creating new files. That is a destructive write operation, if you will.
And in the same boat, transcoding. So say you're doing output of a finished project, you know, you got to
render
back
it out. You got to turn a move file from, you know, ProRes into H.264. Writing out that new file, whether it's a render or just a transcoded web version of it or whatever, absolutely requires a new version. What about project files?
Well, it depends on where you're saving those project files.
But let's say, okay, what type of a volume, to turn this into a quiz show, what type of volume do you need to create a project file?
Well, in order to create a project file, I need to have read-write access to do
that. Exactly, because you're creating something new.
Yes.
What about you open a project file and you make some tweaks to it, and then you want to save it again?
Well, that would be a write action.
Yes, that still requires full read-write because, again, you're modifying a file. And creation and modification is the crux of what requires full read-write access.
This is you're posting a change, if you will. But so what?
And again, what about just doing a render, like render all in Final Cut?
Well, no, because that's depending on where you have the direction of
your
render pointed.
To the volume that you have directed as the destination for the render files themselves, what level of access do you need?
Oh, well, you need write access.
Exactly. Because, again, a render is creating new files. Merrill, 3 for 3, buddy.
All right. So,
ding, ding, ding. You want a gold? David, get this man a gold star.
Well, so here's the thing, right? So if I can't do these very basic functions,
what the hell can I do?
What can I do? Well, here's the deal. Certainly, you can have local project files. Local project files aren't the end of the world, especially when the requirement to put them back up to the network is not a constant requirement. It's something that you would probably do after the work for the day. So to have an immediate and ongoing read-write access for that purpose seems superfluous.
Yeah. And just to clarify, Merle, a little bit. When Merrill is talking about local folks, he's talking about saving these certain types of files out to the storage that's maybe built into or directly connected just to the system that you're using, the editing system, say, the workstation, the laptop that you're on, not this centralized volume that's part of the SAN. So if you have your project file local, or your local drive is the render destination.
Sure. Which I actually personally, I would do that.
Yeah, rendering locally might be good. The only problem is if someone else opens up a project file that you've sent to them and they connect to the media
they may
that's
need
on
to
the
re-render.
SAN, they may need to re-render. Sometimes there is value to having render files be on the SAN. But let's say, and of course, again, if you need to capture to a SAN volume, you need that read-write access. But let's say you just want to use the video footage that's already been captured in a project you're working on, and your project file is local, and your renders are pointing locally. You only need read-only
access.
Oh,
you're not going to give me a quiz here? You're not going to ask me? You're just going to tell me now. Okay, I see how it is.
Sorry.
Can you ask me then the question? Because I was
pretend you didn't hear that, Merrill.
What's
if
that?
You just need to manipulate the footage that's already the capture files that are already on a volume, and I think you probably know the answer because I just said it.
Uh-huh,
but this is, you know, kind of a way that we can restate the point here.
Sure.
If you and to make you feel a little better.
Oh, I'm feeling better already.
You're not Stan, the depressed, suicidal clown.
Stan's actually, I tried to call his house, but he's not answering his phone now. But okay, so do I need access?
So you just want to, you have your project file is stored on your own hard drive, and renders are on your own hard drive, but there's this SAN drive that already has a bunch of footage on it, and you want to edit it. What type of access might you need to that?
I only need read access.
And why do you only need read-only access?
I only need read-only access because the edits that I make, I mean, we're not splicing analog film here. I can make edits, and they are non-destructive edits, and I can save my edits in an XML file even. And that edit is independent of the actual video. It's the joy of being in the 21st century.
You're just making pointers back to the original one. And your render files are certainly having to read off of the original footage in order to manipulate it and write out a new file. Your project files are getting changed and manipulated and modified to refer to kind of endpoints and outpoints and graphics and transitions that you want to have be baked into the video as changes in your renders. But the source footage itself, to be using it in an edit, is only something you need to be able to read from, assuming it's already been captured.
So, I think that's the biggest hurdle that people have intellectually with dealing with this kind of setup, is they say, what do you mean I can't have read-write access? I need it. And the truth of the matter is,
you only need it a little bit at
the
time.
The group of people who are doing editing during the day.
Yep.
They don't need that access.
So let's cut to the point. There's a company that we've had a relationship for a long time. We've done a few different type of these volume locking SANs that we've been talking about over the years. But the one that we've been working with for many, many, many years now is made by a company called SNS, or Studio Network Solutions. And the product is called SANMP. SANMP was originally just a piece of software, and you would have, say, a fiber channel switch, and you would attach a fiber channel RAID to that switch, and you would attach your editors to the switch. They'd have a fiber channel card, and they'd link up to the switch, and they would be running the SANMP software, and it's basically a list of volumes or the volume, and are you connecting to it read-only or read-write, and it works really darn well if you bear in mind this fundamental set of rules about how volume locking SANs work. But they're much cheaper than file locking SANs because you don't need the management servers. SANMP, the client program, is basically throwing these little flags on a little like extra layer of information that's stored on the volumes, and it's just barring other people from getting in. There doesn't need to be a significantly more complex set of management tasks going on than the throwing of these little flags on and off. You know, and so you don't need the management servers that are running their own version of the SAN software with that secondary SAN traffic control network. It's just the storage, a switch, your client systems with their connections to that switch, and the SAN software, SANMP. Now, Studio Network Solutions came out with their own storage appliance called the Evo, which, don't even ask me what it stands for, Evolutionary.
Yeah, I don't know.
And Evo is basically a system that is both a file server and volume locking SAN storage
so
wrapped into one.
So basically, everything we've talked about it can support.
But it doesn't do file locking SAN. If you have multiple users writing to a volume at the same time, it's still using a Ethernet file sharing protocol. If you want people to connect using iSCSI over Ethernet or true fiber channel connections, and all of which are possibilities to have installed right into the back of the Evo storage device, they need to adhere to these SAN volume locking rules, and they're running the SAN MP software on their editing workstations to choose which volume they're connecting to and if it's read or write. Now, we were also talking a lot about rendering locally or having the project files stored locally.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the thing. You have to think about your workflow a little bit with a volume locking SAN, but maybe you want to create one big volume for the raw capture files, and really only Frank and his ingest system is usually connected to that read-write because he's the one who's ingesting everything. But then maybe you actually carve up a number of little editing, a number of other littler volumes for
and those
your
volumes,
editors.
For each of those volumes, you have independent read-write access.
And that's the thing. So maybe you have five editors plus an ingest system.
Sure.
And you create one big volume for the ingest guy, and he's usually connected to it read-write because he needs to add new footage to it. And then you create five littler volumes for your editors and edit 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Each usually are connected to their own volume 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and each editor has read-write access to their own volume. That's where they put their project files. That's where they point their renders to. That's where they put any miscellaneous files that they need to store. You could still have someone read off of someone else's working space volume. You can change who's connected to which working space volume at which time just through the SANMP application. It's a really bearable way of working. And again, the costs of these type of systems is a lot less than a true file locking fiber channel SAN. And yet the performance, if you have people connected over fiber channel, is a lot greater than a typical gigabit Ethernet system.
You know, one of the things we really haven't talked too much about, and I do want to wrap up here, but I think this might be a good way to close it out. When we talked about media asset management, we talked about how important it was to also have somebody who is the point person within the organization to really manage the process and manage what it is and what it isn't and how it's used, right? So do we need...
You need a mom. Media operations manager.
We need a mom.
So, yeah. You know, it's a good point. Moving to these centralized storage systems is a great opportunity to begin to think a little more, you know, strategically and in a more organized fashion about your data. Because, gosh, a pile of individual FireWire hard drives or desktop drives, you know, leads to mismanagement almost inherently, and the spreading around of your data and losing track of what footage is on which drive.
And this is the precursor. This really is the precursor to media asset management. In order to,
yes,
to get to that place where you have everything centralized, but now you don't know how to manage it, you have to first have it centralized.
Because it's very easy for the centralized storage system to become almost as confused in the lack of management as to where the files are as FireWire drives are.
I've seen file servers. In another life, I was an IT guy. And I think this still holds true today. If you give a bunch of users sort of unregulated access to storage space on a network,
oh God,
they will do whatever the hell they want with
it. You need a taskmaster.
Sure.
You need to have someone who, they need to be management organized. They need to be management oriented. They need to be able to kind of say, guys, here's a directory structure. Here's the root level. Here is a group of first level subdirectories with very specific names, with very specific types of stuff. Or we're always going to create for each client a directory, and it's going to have a very specific client name. And every project file we ever generate is always going to have that client name as part of the file name. And it's all going to always live in their folder. And their folder is always going to have these five subdirectories: project files, raw footage, finished pieces,
sure,
you know, extra data, like,
or,
you know,
or whatever. So I guess,
but you need having a system, right?
You gotta. This is all about organization. At the end of the day, every single phase that we ever implement when it comes to video workgroup environments and the workflow associated to editing and ultimately the management of that asset and the archive and or backup of it has to do with keeping your stuff organized.
Yeah, all the benefits you get off of a SAN, the RAID protection, the high performance. Again, multiple people, I don't know if we stress this enough, when you have a capture, when you have a video file that someone needs to manipulate for a project on a SAN or even a file server, you don't need to duplicate it for multiple people to be working with it at the same time. Again, if they're non-destructively working with that media, they all can be reading off of it and be manipulating it within the context of various individual sequences and projects that they're working on. You don't need to dupe everything. All of these benefits are great, but you need to also have some organization in the way that you manage these centralized file systems, or it just becomes a virtual ugly bunch of FireWire drives that are maybe a little less precarious physically, but aren't necessarily adding to the benefits that a consolidated storage system, you know, can provide.
And the benefits.
Which is organized. It's centralized and organized.
It is. And at the end of the day, what does that mean for you? It means that you're spending less time
looking for stuff,
doing stuff that is not making money,
copying files between drives and waiting for little lines to cross across screens while data is getting copied and you can't really work effectively while that copy is taking place. You know,
we all have billable hours, and, you know, and at the end of the day, we got to really focus.
And,
on,
you know, it's nice, right? A SAN is not necessarily a luxury. When people really think about what eats up their hours in a day that could be billable, and they start to really think about, like, how much of my time is waiting to copy files between drives or searching for a file when I don't know which of the five FireWire drives it's on. You really think about that in terms of the billable time you have to apply to your work, and these SAN systems or in file servers or whatever approach you take for workgroup storage can really pay for themselves. No one would put these things in if all they were was a cost. And I really stress this as a sales guy whose living is based on this stuff. No, I say this as a consultant who is well aware of the realistic scenarios in a lot of these environments, which is, these things can save you time significantly and allow you to make more money because your time can be spent on the creative tasks that at the end of the day your users are paying you for. When they pay you to commission a video, to make a video, they themselves are not paying you to copy data between drives, and they're not paying you to find a file on a drive that was on your third B-roll drive from, you know, 2008 that you need to reincorporate into their new project that they're paying you for. They're paying you for the product. They're paying you for your creativity. They're paying you for your skill set, your narrative skills, and your storytelling skills through moving picture and audio and graphics. And they don't care that you have to spend extra time in your day looking for stuff. They don't care that you have to copy stuff. They don't care that your FireWire drive died. They're paying you for the end product. And these SANs can allow you to bring in more of that revenue and cut out more of those
SANs,
extraneous activities.
SANs? NASA's, you know what they do?
SANs.
SANs save money. They do.
We love it.
All right, so
That was it. And this is a complex subject. We are always available to talk more about this. Give us a holler. I'm Nick Gold.
I'm Merrill Davis.
We're of Chesapeake Systems, Chesa.com. Please rate the podcast on iTunes. We've made it into the new and noteworthy sub section of the technology section on iTunes. Thank you for listening. And until next week, we are the Workflow Show.
Peace out.
Later.